Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org. KPFT Houston.
Below Your Knees by Austin, Texas' very own Ray Lynch. Signals Thursday, 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host tonight, Warren Holloman, and I'm proud to be on the So What's Your Story team with co-hosts Mary Edgerton, Greg Audell, Hank Rubicek, Tatiana Gago, Eric Keen, Christy Gorman, Arwood Taylor, and Paul Topekian. Each week, we celebrate the power of story by bringing you astonishing tellers who take us on captivating journeys, and then they bring us safely home. Tonight, we're ringing in the new year with help from three of my favorite Austin storytellers. Given the festive nature of this evening, Susan, Lottie, and Paul decided to have a little fun with their bios. So let's begin with Susan Lippincott Mack. She started telling stories as soon as she could talk, and her older brothers often wished she would just stop. She had a career as a corporate storyteller, but she got addicted to sharing personal stories 3 years ago. She lives in Austin with her husband, her two teenage children, and one fur baby. Susan, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Hi, Warren. I'm going to be telling a story that happened shortly after a memorable New Year's called The Suitcase.
Wonderful. And you've got to tell me about this fur baby. Is it a dog, cat, ferret?
So Minion is a rescue, and the breed, they say, is terrier mix. And he basically has all of the energy of a Jack Russell and a 50-pound body. And we have lots of stories about him. We jokingly just call him the evil minion, even though he goes between wanting to snuggle and take strangers off the planet with almost no warning.
And what does a corporate storyteller do when she's not trying to save her family from this dog?
Corporate storytelling is really helping companies figure out their story. And I came to the conclusion that that is one of the most important things any business can do. Because when you really understand your story, you also understand what things you should develop in your product and how you should explain it to the market and what market you go after. And so I spent a lot of years working doing corporate storytelling or just helping people create content to tell their story.
Cool. Our second guest, Lottie Loera, is an artist, storyteller, and also an animal lover. He's a native Texan, grew up in Houston, who currently resides in Austin with his partner and the remains of two elderly cats who hated each other in life, but in death, they sit side by side on the mantle. So please tell me about that mantle.
Well, the mantle's their home now. When I moved in with Steve, he had a cat, and I had a cat, and we just naturally assumed they would get along as well as we did, and that was quite incorrect. They hated each other on sight. So they each got half the house, And there was a time during the middle of the day where we'd open the neutral zone and one would get control of that. And then we'd take it back and give it to the other later in the afternoon. But now there's no fighting. There's no hissing. They're just keeping each other company. And I hope they like it. I can't really tell.
That's great. And finally, Paul Normandin is a large man with a big mouth. These are his words, who loves to tell stories to anyone who can't outrun him. Paul learned to tell stories from the loving feedback of other people's children while teaching junior and senior high Sunday school for 13 years. Paul remains humbled to be on any stage with his many supportive and loving friends like Susan, Lottie, and Warren. Paul, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
And it's interesting to me that you included being a Sunday school teacher in your bio. Not everybody does that. But the funny thing is, the first time I met you, that you told a story about being a Sunday school teacher. And as if I remember correctly, this was maybe 10 years ago, but it won the Houston Moth Grand Slam. And I thought, if this guy can win a Grand Slam with a Sunday school story, he must be pretty good. Tell me about that Sunday school class.
Thank you. It went like this. I'm a Methodist. I created a class for Sunday morning. It was simple. It was going to use these four criteria. One week we talk about the Bible on a given issue. The next we talk about how traditionally we treated that issue. And then we talk about modern inclinations and then what we thought about it. And we'd have a 4-week period. And then on the fifth week, we'd go do something. We'd make a difference on that issue. We'd visit somewhere and make a difference. And after 2 months, that class went belly up and nobody was coming because it was too much work. And I was devastated. And the education director came to me and said, listen, I know you're free next Sunday. Could you teach the senior high Sunday school class? And I was just like, no, I can't. No. He goes, listen, can you just babysit? We don't have a teacher for that.
Well,
and that was it.
Just the guest to begin with, just a brief anecdote about a memorable New Year's Eve or Christmas holiday.
I am petrified. I grew up believing New Year's Eve was the night people died from drinking, drunk drivers, whatever. So my family, when I started my family, I convinced everybody we just stayed home and didn't do anything. And when I finally got into the Austin improv community, I found out on the night before New Year's Eve, because most performers are working New Year's Eve, they have a thing called Same Year's Eve. And all the performers just gather on stage and they just do improv together. And it's just a big mess. But I was so proud and excited to be in that mess. And that night we counted down to midnight and I was just ecstatic to be doing this for the first time in my life. And by the end of the night, I was invited to 5 New Year's Eve parties. And my entire life changed.
Lottie, can you top that?
Oh, I can't top it. I can go under it a bit, I think. In 2010, my partner, Chris, we had been together for about 16 years. He passed away. And by the time the new year came, I had started with the flu. It developed into pneumonia. My dog had to go to the emergency hospital to get something done to her eye. And all of us decided, I had 2 other cats at the time, that we were just canceling the new year. We were not going to do anything else this year. We would start all over the following January, and we were just going to consider it an extenuation of 2010, and we left it at that.
How about you, Susan?
Well, you'd think my most memorable New Year's would be New Year's 2004, because I got married to my husband, Chris, on New Year's Day. But I would actually say it was the year before that, in 2003, when we'd been dating about 6 weeks long distance with him in Austin and me in California. And I had kept my plans for Christmas, which involved going and hiding in Costa Rica for 10 days. So we had to go 10 whole days of not speaking to each other. And then we found ourselves together on New Year's Day, sitting on my couch, watching the UT football game. And I brought buckwheat pancakes that I had made to Chris, my Chris, not Lottie's Chris. And we just snuggled up on the couch, and all of a sudden he just looked at me and said, I'm going to marry you. Oh. And I said, I think you have to ask me instead of announcing that, but I'll say yes. And then it was a few more months before that happened. But then a year later on New Year's Day, that's exactly what happened. We got married.
Oh, wow. If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. I'm here with my guests, Susan Mack, Lottie Loera, and Paul Normandin from Austin, Texas. And we're telling stories about the New Year's and other things from our life that we want to share with friends on this New Year's Eve show. Susan, you've got a story called The Suitcase that kind of relates to the little mini story you just told. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, well, so it's kind of a Valentine's Day story, but still holidays. But it comes out from that moment when Chris announced that we were going to get married. It meant I knew that I actually had to introduce him to my family. So right around Valentine's Day, we made plans for the first steps of this to happen. And we were going to fly together up to Portland, Oregon, to go visit my oldest brother and his family. Well, as we were packing for the trip the night before, Chris looked at me and said, hey, do you want to share a suitcase? And I had to pause for a minute with that because it didn't matter that in order to spend more time in California with me, he basically moved into my house. So we were sharing a bathroom and a closet and a bed, but somehow sharing a suitcase was a level of intimacy I really wasn't ready for, because where's the surprise in that? There's like secrets that go in a suitcase. But I thought, I have never been in a relationship like this one. I'm going to go ahead and do it. We'll share the suitcase. And so I packed the stuff that I was going to bring into his rollerboard with all of his stuff. And when we left for the airport the next morning to go to SFO and catch our flight, that was the only suitcase that came in the car with us. Well, we got to SFO, and standing in the security line, we were kind of hungry. And part of it was that we hadn't eaten breakfast yet, but the other part was that we were just still so new in this relationship that we were constantly hungry for each other. And this wonderful, new, strong, emotional connection was so powerful that it just drew our hands together and our bodies together and our lips together. So we were probably making out in the security line, making everyone around us want to vomit until we got through security. And then the physical, actual stomach hunger took over, and we headed straight for the diner, the sit-down restaurant. Even though we only had about 40 minutes, we figured, yeah, it's airport. They'll probably be fast. So we told the hostess we were in a hurry. She said it wasn't a problem. She seated us, and then we waited. And it was probably not that long, not more than a couple minutes, but it felt like a long time, even as we happily stared into each other's eyes and conversed about things we don't remember anymore. And then finally, the waitress came towards our table and then veered to the table to the right of us to refill their water. And I said, hey, excuse me. And she said, oh, I'll be right with you, and walked away. And I thought, okay, clock's ticking. A few more minutes passed. She comes. She goes to the table on the other side of us and takes their check. And again, I said, hey, excuse me. And she said I'd be right with you, and walked away. Ooh. This was a problem. She was harshing my mellow. I did not want to have to sit there and be irritated with some incompetent, overworked waitress because I wanted to stay in my love bubble. And as I looked into Chris's green eyes filled with happiness, I thought, I have a choice. I can stay in my love bubble. And I looked at him and I said, let's leave. And he just looked so relieved and said, yes, let's leave. And so we stood up and I put my purse on my shoulder and I looked around and I said, hey, where's our bag? And he said, oh, your purse, it's on your shoulder. And I said, no, our suitcase. And his face just, his eyes get big and he goes into shock. And he says, oh no, I left it at security. And so we go running back to security, and it's probably been like 5 or 10 minutes at this point. maybe even 15. And fortunately, there, sitting in security, was the suitcase, surrounded by about 8 TSA agents, all wearing like the orange vests and the security uniforms, maybe even guns, I don't know, looking very, very serious, because this is only about a year and a half after 9/11. And Chris goes up and says, "Hey, that's my bag." And the main guy says, "Why did you leave it here? We were about to take it out on the tarmac and shoot bullets in it. What are you doing?" And Chris just looks at him and says, "I left it because I'm a complete idiot." And you could see these people just visibly, like, the tension wave out of their shoulders as they look at him and realize that this absent-minded professor probably really is an idiot instead of a terrorist, so they can believe him. And they give him our bag. And we walk away. And Chris looks at me like, "Why are you acting so weird?" Because I am not just smiling or smirking. I am just exuding this level of joy that's even bigger than our usual level of joy at being around each other. And he was like, "Why are you so happy?" And I said, "Because you did it first." Because what Chris did not yet understand about me, he was used to seeing the organized, competent, capable me, which was the result of the fact that I had what was at the time undiagnosed ADHD and had developed a lot of great coping strategies. So he was not familiar with the fact that I could write a doctoral dissertation on the topic of where are my keys, for example. And I knew that no matter how great my coping strategies were, there were still going to be times where I did things exactly like this. So I explained this to him. I said, "You have no idea how many times in our life together I'm going to do things just like this. And because you did it first, you're not going to be able to yell at me or get upset." And he just looked at me and said, "I love you." And in that moment, we gave each other the greatest, greatest gift. And it was the gift that we were going to laugh at the world together and laugh with each other and not laugh at each other. And when we had problems, we would try to face them shoulder to shoulder instead of spending a lot of time on finger pointing. And this has remained so true that like 10 years after this event, when I was telling this story to someone, I realized that, hey, my stuff was in the suitcase too. And so like maybe I actually participated in leaving it at security. And it took me 10 years to realize that. And even then, when I went and laughingly shared this with Chris, he laughed instead of finger pointing and said he'd never thought of it that way. And so every year on our anniversary, on New Year's Day, when we're celebrating our anniversary, I actually think about this moment and moments like it. And I think it is the thing that I'm most thankful for.
Oh my, I love that story. Paul.
I love the term love bubble. That is so, God, that explains it so perfectly.
Yeah, well, you know, you see people who are in those new overwhelming relationships where they're just like, "Oh my God, I'm so in love. I can't," like, it's just overwhelming and it's a beautiful spot to be in. But quite frankly, you know, we're 18 years in from the love bubble and I would say we're still madly in love with each other, but it's just much more manageable.
It's less bubbly.
Less bubbly.
I really want to travel with y'all to see a make out in a security line. I kind of really want to just see that now as the adults I know you to be. That would be fun for me.
Yeah, that sadly, that's not our normal mode of operation these days. We do sometimes try to like make out a little bit to embarrass our kids, but it's not all that often.
They say a good story paints some memorable pictures, motifs. That's what you did in that story. I imagine the same place where you're making out, you come back later with the drama about the suitcase. That the other thing I thought of was drawing from my memory of Paul's Sunday school teacher experiences. There's some verse in the Bible about in our weakness is our strength, or, you know, vulnerability is what can really make us truly strong. And the fact that your husband or your fiance just, instead of trying to bluster his way through that, just admitted that he had made a stupid mistake. Suddenly you just love him at that point and you're pulling for him. I love that part of it. Yeah. And that's what a good story is too, I think, is being vulnerable. And people don't want to hear about our successes. They want to hear about our failures and how we manage to, you know, live with them or overcome them. So way to go. Any other comments, Lottie or Paul?
It's a beautiful story, Susan. I love it.
Well, Paul, with that, I guess you're next. Excellent. It's New Year's Eve. We're sitting around the fireplace, sharing stories over Zoom, which is our metaphorical fireplace. What have you got for us?
This was a terrible year. 2020 was really heavy and hard and challenging. And it started off for me with my mom getting very, very ill and passing away in February. And as we came to Christmas time and the time you get with families and you Zoom, I kept having this recurring memory of her. Turns out we've had other terrible years in our history, and 1968 was one of the worst I can remember. The president of the United States was so reviled on both sides, he resigned on March 31st of that year. 5 days later, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. 3 months later, the most likely Democrat to replace the president, whose brother had been assassinated right after I was born, he was assassinated. My family loved all these people. And these were just a few of the things that were turning our country upside down. I was a little kid. I was six. So that all, I felt all the things they were going through, but I wasn't part of it directly. But my family, starting that year, my dad had started flying around the country. He had this really great gig. And in order to get it, he had to pass a whole bunch of tests. He had to go to a bunch of schools. He had to become an expert in radar technology. And it was a really big deal. And each time he left Providence, Rhode Island, where we were living, mom would get sad. And I would feel her sadness. I was like the family empath. And when dad would leave, the family that we had in Rhode Island, four aunts, two uncles, grandparents on both sides, they just kind of filled the void. They would come over to the house and things would be okay. And then one day in June, dad said he passed all his tests and he got the job. And my mom and my two little sisters and I got on a plane and we flew to Florida, because my dad had started his gig at NASA in Cape Canaveral. I was from Providence, Rhode Island, a relatively big city with giant history, and we were moving to this little rural town that barely had streetlights. It barely had anything. It was just a beach where they launched rockets from. I was completely confused. I didn't know where anything was. I could find my way around there, but here I didn't know where anything was. And I wasn't alone. And not long after we went there, dad, who had to go out in the middle of the ocean to track the Apollo project and keep track of the astronauts as they orbited the Earth. And then when they left the Earth's orbit, he had to know where they were at all the time. So he sat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which meant he would leave weeks before the launch, leaving mom and me and my little sister, Laura, and my little sister, Carol, all alone. And it was confusing time. There was no support for my mom. There wasn't anybody coming to the house and helping her out. And after Apollo 7 finished, dad came home, but then he immediately went back out to sea in December for Apollo 8. When he left, I started hearing all the stories about Apollo 8. this country that had gone through so many things was living in fear of this launch. They were so afraid because for the first time in human history, human beings were going to be out of sight of the Earth. And there were so many crazy stories going around the world about what was going to happen when we sent people out of sight of Earth, when we sent them to the dark side of the moon, when we made contact with whatever was back there. Dad had been out to sea for a while when we got to watch the rocket launch from our front door on December 21st. It was beautiful. And then everything just went back to normal except for the fear, the waiting. And when we woke up on Christmas Eve on the 24th of December, we heard that the astronauts had made it back around. And there was a connection. The radar picked them up and they were able to communicate with Earth and everything was fine. And my mom looked at us and said, "That's because you're dad." I'm not sure my little sisters understood that, but I felt a moment of pride with my mom. And then we went back to being alone on Christmas Eve. What do you do with kids on Christmas Eve as the sun starts to go down? You put them to bed because you're alone and you have three kids and they're all wanting Christmas the next day. So she put us to bed with promises that the next morning everything would be okay and we'd have presents under the tree. So I was completely surprised when she woke us up about 11 p.m. And she was dressed up real pretty. But she was also really harried and nervous and a little panicky. And she got us all dressed up in our fine clothes. And then we went outside to get in the car and it was raining. And you know, I mentioned it was dark. It was really dark and cold. Nobody had halogen headlamps on their car. So as we started driving, soaking wet, looking for something, my mom kept asking me, I realized I had been upgraded. I was in the passenger seat because when Dad left, he had told me I was the man of the house. I didn't know what that meant. I'm not sure I still do. But I knew when Dad wasn't in the car, I was the navigator. And when Mom asked me, "Where's the Catholic Church?" I panicked. I didn't know. In Rhode Island, I knew. Mimi took me to the Catholic Church, this giant stone building that's ages old, that had candles and everybody spoke in Latin and didn't understand a dang thing when we were in there, but I remember it. And having gone every Sunday with Mimi, it was a safe place. On the road that night, as we were searching slowly, looking for that Catholic Church, I started to worry. And my little sister Carol started to cry. It took us almost an hour to find it. And when we rolled up, we realized that everybody else may have been having a really bad year too, because there were no parking spaces at the church. And there were so many cars, they had parked in the mud and the grass off to the side of the road. And when we got out, it was still raining. Mom picked up Carol, and then she grabbed Laura's hand, and we started to walk through the mud to the front doors of this little teeny tiny wood building. It was cold and wet, and I was holding on to my mother's skirt. When we climbed up the stairs and got under the awning and out of the rain, my mom's face changed. I remember looking up at her because we had been making this march and all of a sudden she had just stopped. And she's looking at the front doors and she's rethinking this mission to go to midnight mass at a Catholic church. And she's having this moment of maybe this is a bad idea to walk in late. Maybe it's a bad idea to walk in with three kids, one crying. Maybe it's a bad idea to go in without a husband. I just stood there holding her skirt when the door magically opened. Someone must have seen us from the inside. And he invited us in. And I remember as the door opened, the warmth from that space just overwhelmed me. And I realized I was cold and wet. And I felt it so clearly, but that warmth was so inviting. I saw all those people. I didn't get a chance to look at my mom's face because I was looking at the poinsettias and the candles, and I knew that there was safety inside. And when we crossed that threshold that night, I felt a little less alone. Thank you.
Such a memory. From how long ago was that?
That was 1968, 52 years ago. I was 6 years old and precocious and a pain in the backside for most of the people who knew me.
And that's a vivid memory for you.
And I think with my mom's passing, it flooded out a little.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that really, this year, I've really been thinking a lot about the lines from Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas about, you know, and next year we all will be together if the fates allow. And I'm hoping that we can have some kind of memory just like that in 2021.
Yeah. And you spoke to something earlier about good stories being about the vulnerabilities. And I think this is one of my favorite memories of my mother. And I know that doesn't seem to jive with how human beings relate to each other. But for me, that was a moment where my mom was completely vulnerable and honest with me. Yeah. And I love that moment.
She was also absolutely brave.
Yes.
I heard you tell the story the other night at the Houston Storytellers Guild through Zoom. And when my wife got home from work that night, I told her about it. And the thing that I seized on for some reason was the memory of hearing your mother cry through the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the things that seemed to happen a lot when Dad was gone.
Yeah.
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 It's hard. I mean, Chris has had to travel a lot for business, and we kind of knew that when we got together, but you get to moments when you're mom alone with the kids, and it can just be hard.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank Lottie, you. Have you got a story for us?
I do. Let me just say that I am the kind of person, I lose my keys, my wallet, and my phone on a really semi-regular basis. I've gotten better about it by making sure that I have a place specifically where everything goes. But if something comes up, if there's a thought in my head or I see a cupcake, absolutely nothing will end up where it should be, except for the cupcake, which will quickly find its way into my mouth. Now, I wouldn't say that I'm disorganized, but most people wouldn't understand my method of organization. And I have to be honest, sometimes I'm not sure that I understand it myself. When I met Steve, we were both middle-aged. And that's actually being a bit generous because we're both middle-aged. We're both going to live to be over 100 years old. So let's just say that we met when we were late in our lives. And I think folks who meet late, they have to work a little harder than they would if they had met earlier, because there are aspects of us as people that are just kind of pretty well cooked. And I myself, I'm an artist, and Steve is an engineer. And well, that makes for some really interesting realizations about who we think we are and who we really are. Steve loves order. Neat and everything in its place. And I live my life in what I like to call a controlled clutter. Although there are times when I have to admit, I'm not really sure who is supposed to be in control of it. Now, when we met, Steve and I were both heartbroken. He had gone through a bad breakup and my partner, my previous partner, passed away. And this gave us something immediately in common. And we were a safe place for each other. And that made it easy to overlook the traits that didn't necessarily mesh. For instance, as an engineer, Steve loves systems. He loves creating systems. When I moved in, I put all our DVDs with his and we mixed them all together in this one clump in the wall. And we had way too many CDs and neither of us really wanted to keep any of these. So we decided that we would listen to what we wanted to, keep what we had to, and get rid of everything else. And the next day I went to work. Steve was at home and he decided to put everything in order. And I don't know about you, but to me, the first thing that comes to mind is alphabetical. I mean, how else do you put things in order? But you see, that is not Steve's way. That is someone else's system. And he wanted one of his own. So he built this giant spreadsheet based on where everything was on the shelves. And there was no order when we put them in, put them away. But what he decided to do was locate each one where it was, create a label for the shelf, then create a label for the slot where they were. And then he showed it to me. And I have to admit, I was a bit perplexed by how to use it. But he was thrilled, absolutely thrilled to show this thing off. There was a space for everything. Every shelf held like 50 of these things. So when we were looking things, he was able to pull out, this is this artist, this is this one that you're looking for. And finally, there was one that I really wanted to find. I said, where is the soundtrack for Suspiria? It's an old horror movie that I really like the music to. And he showed me where it was supposed to be on the spreadsheet. We went through, we looked for it, but it wasn't there. And I said as much to him. I said, you know, I don't think it's where it's supposed to be. And he was absolutely positive that it was me. I just did not understand the system. Well, then he looked himself and I saw his face scrunch up. And he looked up and down the whole shelf and I started helping him. And I said, well, clearly it's not where it's supposed to be. How do we find this? And he looked at me. And his face scrunched up even further. We can't. There's no way. I did not plan for this possibility. Well, it was several days later. Eventually, we found everything. We were able to listen to it. But it was one of those times when I think Steve got a better idea about his nature of order. One of the things that he and I agree on are things really should be put away when you're done with them. We can both think that makes absolute sense, but Steve is a bit overzealous. Once when I was making toast, it had literally been seconds before I got the bread into the toaster. When I turned around looking for the little twisty tie to put the bread back away, it was gone. And I was crazy looking around the kitchen for this thing. And he finally said, what are you looking for? And I told him the little twisty tie for the bread. He said, oh, I saw that on the counter. I thought it was trash and I threw it away. Well, I just looked at him and, well, now we have a new rule that nothing gets thrown away. I'm in the kitchen without me being asked first. And while I will say that I agree with Steve and I'm a firm believer in putting things away when you're done with them, I am not as quick with tasks as Steve is. He has a hit list and he goes 1, 2, 3, right down the list. But me, as an artist, I tend to have about a dozen projects going at any one time. And none of them can be put away until they're done. And some of these projects take years to finish. For instance, I'm working on a new illustration and something catches my mind and I start a different illustration, but I can't put the previous one away because it's not finished yet. So I have piles all over the place of what I'm working on. And I spend a lot of time growing through these to try and figure out exactly what I should be working on. And I know myself reasonably well. So I have a place at the studio where I keep my keys because I am not the person who's going to be able to find these things later. At home, I have a shelf where my wallet, my keys, and my phone go. That's because that's where I know they will always be. But sometimes it doesn't always work out. Sometimes my system doesn't work just like Steve's didn't. There was a day when I arrived at the studio, I had an overflow of ideas on some new illustrations that I was working on, and I had to get them down and print it out so I could adjust coloring and scale. And I was really excited about these new illustrations because they were black and white, and I was going to use them to etch some glassware. And I ran several samples on different things. I put some other things on other substrates, some wood, some ceramic. I was really happy. I took pictures of them all, and I packed everything up, because I was going to bring everything home to show everything off to Steve. I turn off the lights. I turn off the equipment. I close the front door, and my keys are not in my hand. Well, I always put them in that coffee cup that I have on the dining room table at my studio. But they're not there. And just like Steve with his CDs, I don't have a fallback plan on this. I don't know where they are. So I have to turn on all the lights. I trace my steps. For over an hour, I am searching for these keys, and they had simply popped out of existence. Now, Steve has watched me lose things on a semi-regular basis, and he does not like it, mostly because it means he's going to be drafted and helping me find whatever I have lost. So I called him at home and I said, you know, I don't want to talk about this right now. I've lost my keys. I can't find them anywhere. Can you please come over to the studio with the spare keys for the studio and the car? I've looked everywhere. And yes, I know I should be more careful. I don't want to talk about this right now. And he was silent. But I could hear on the phone that he really wanted to say something. But he held his tongue, and I was ecstatic when he showed up at the front door. He looked at me, and I was afraid of what was going to happen because I knew what was going to happen. He said, where exactly did you look? Oh, I became so annoyed. I looked everywhere. I don't want to look again. I'll look tomorrow when I've had a chance to sleep and I've had something to eat. Please. Can we just go home? But this was something on Steve's list, and he hates to have something on his list that is not completed. I was both annoyed and upset with myself and with him for asking him specifically what I asked him not to do. Come on, he said. Just show me where you walked when you got here. I walked him through. I came in. I opened the front door. I went right down here to turn on the equipment, to turn on the laser, to turn on the printer, to turn on the heating press. And I was working on an illustration. And he looked around. He says, this is where you were when you started working on the illustration. I said, yes. He moved a box. And then he moved a smaller box. And then he moved a piece of paper that I had drawn on. He said, are these your keys right here? He had looked for not even a minute. And I realized I was just stunned into silence because what Steve had done, he built a system for me. And this system worked. And it was for the first time in a long time that I had actually felt seen. I had felt known, and I felt understood in a way I don't think I'd ever felt completely understood before. And I just looked at him, and I was amazed. And all of a sudden, I felt that way that I did when I first met him. And I realized this is what it feels like when you fall in love all over again.
Bonnie, my gosh, that story is beautiful. And I was sitting next to Vicky the whole time going, oh, I'm like Steve. Oh, you're like Lottie. No wonder I love you so much.
And Lottie, when you started that story, I thought it was a commentary on my line about how I have a doctorate in where are my keys.
Yes, I know. When you said that earlier, I thought this flows very well. That's me.
I was thinking, did you tell this story? Because I'm telling a story about not knowing where I am and getting lost. This was so, I was like, we have a theme. What the heck?
We do.
We did. We had an accidental theme.
Full disclosure, guess what my son gave me for Christmas?
Pompous?
One of these little cards that you put in your wallet that enables you, no, an app you put on your phone.
Yes.
And then a sticker on your keys and a card in your wallet so that you'll never lose your keys or your wallet again.
I got three of those 2 weeks ago.
I got those before, but the problem is they eventually run out of batteries and you have to like remember to charge them up. And that's why they don't work anymore.
One reason I think this is a great story is it seems for most of the story, you think it's a story about keys. You know, something very mundane and everyday and irritation, but it's not important because we're all artists. We know keys aren't really important. But it's really a story about love.
And yeah, it is.
Surprises yeah. us at the end.
And one of the reasons everybody loves to hear a story from Lottie is because he consistently makes the mundane into something powerful and beautiful.
Ah. Yes.
You're both so kind.
Just tell them the truth, my friend.
If you're just tuning in, this is Warren Holloman. This is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT. I think I'll take a couple of minutes and talk about the Houston storytelling scene. And then since we've got our Austin friends here, I'm going to give you guys a couple of minutes to talk about Austin and also to talk about your own personal, what you've got coming up in your world of art and creativity. We'll begin with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild, of course, has a monthly storytelling swap. It's the fourth Tuesday of every month, and thanks to the miracle of Zoom, the swap continues. It's a great way to learn about the art of storytelling. It's a friendly, casual, supportive environment. You can tell a story or just listen. You can ask for feedback or not. If you visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org, you'll see information about all their activities and resources, including you'll see that they have an archive of 12 years of our radio program, So What's Your Story? Just click on the radio program tab and you'll be in storytelling heaven. I also want to mention the Tejas Storytelling Association, because coming up soon in March is the annual Texas Storytelling Festival. It will be virtual this year, March 11 to 14, but that's a good thing in a way. It makes it possible for us all to attend without even leaving our homes. I know Paul told a story there last year. I know I'm telling one there this year, and I encourage everybody to check them out. It's Tejas, T-E-J-A-S, Storytelling Association. And then thanks to the miracle of Zoom, The Moth is still producing great stories. If you go to www.themoth.org, you'll see all kinds of virtual story slams and main stage performances, podcasts, and of course, The Moth Radio Hour. And now I'm going to turn it over to Paul and Lottie and Susan to talk about what's going on in Austin and what's going on in your own storytelling world.
Well, I'll sum up the things that are going on right now in Austin. TestifyATX.com will lead you to a Zoom meeting that happens once a month. And that is five storytellers sharing true personal stories with a host. And Lottie and I both are producers there. And I don't know about Lottie, but it's one of the prides of my life that I get to work with these people and do these things.
That's true.
There is a thing called Drinking with the Saints. It's not going on right now, but we're hoping it happens as soon as we get out of the pandemic, along with some other things we're missing right now, Backyard Story Night in Austin and Hyde Park Storytelling. Austin has a great tradition of storytelling and a lot of organized storytelling events that seem not to be happening as frequently now. So that I'm sad about. But if you want to check out storytelling and all of its iterations that are true and personal, there's a Facebook group called Storytelling True and Personal where all of these things get set. Also, I am starting on Wednesday night in January, every Wednesday night in January, a storytelling class at Merlin Works. So if you go to merlinworks.com, you can read all about their new storytelling classes.
And Paul, that's on Zoom, right?
Yes, those, all of these, everything is Zoom these days.
So if anyone listening to this in Houston wanted to take a storytelling class for Paul, and I've sat in on the showcases, you can do that because it's on Zoom.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay. Susan, Lottie?
Well, so I've been still trying to show up at as many storytelling things as I can. And I did a couple of Moth Story Slams. Actually, I did Seattle, which was fun, being in Austin. It's a little harder to shift to storytelling through Zoom because the feedback of the live audience just isn't quite the same. But I think with Testify, Paul has actually done, and Lottie has done a good job with having people keep their mics on so you can still get the feeling of the room. It makes a big difference. Testify was part of what helped me get addicted to live personal storytelling because I've actually been going through a bunch of medical stuff and I ended up finding Testify, and it was one of the things that helped me like really work to get out of back pain because I wanted to still stand up and tell stories. But I have actually, I wanted to share that I am starting a Master's of Fine Arts program in creative writing, specifically in creative nonfiction. And I'm really working on looking at the difference between telling something on the stage and writing it on the page, because there are differences between the two. And I'm having a lot of fun with that. And that means in a couple of years, I will be walking out with a book-length project. And right now I would predict that that's going to be the book I've been saying I'm going to write for a couple of years, entitled 3 months, which is about spending 3 months knowing that you were going to have brain surgery. And it's fun.
Yeah, I do illustrations. I do mostly Day of the Dead art. I'm working on some other things with dogs and stuff like that. But if you want to see anything else about me, just go to LottieLoetta.com and you'll see all my artwork and everything else I'm up to.
Well, I read that you're considered Austin's Day of the Dead artist. That's what the internet says about you.
Yeah. Well, how nice. Yeah, I've been doing it for a long time. It's a business I started over 20 years ago.
Wow. And Lottie's being modest. I was told by Susan that he had won a Grand Slam, Story Slam, in Miami. Is that correct?
Miami for the Moth, yeah.
How was this, virtual or live?
No, this was live. This was before everything happened. My partner took me to Miami a couple of years ago as a gift, and he bought tickets to the Moth because he knew I loved the Moth, and I got to participate, and I won that one. And then they called me back to come back for the Grand Slam, and he said, well, of course we have to go to that.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough, I won that one as well.
Did you know anybody there?
No, we didn't know, which made it a little bit easier, to be honest with you. I don't know these people. I'm never going to see them again. Let's just see what happens.
And I think, Paul, you did something like that too. Didn't you go to a story slam in New Orleans?
I went to two story slams outside of my comfort zone. The first being in Brooklyn at a sold out event. Vicky's hips were hurting and I had to fight to get her a chair. I literally bribed somebody so she could sit because it was SRO. And I was so nervous to tell that night. And when the host came up and said, whatever you do, don't tell a story like this. And then basically outlined my story.
Oh, no.
I thought I was going to die. And then they called my name. And I was like, no. And that was my first experience telling at the Moth.
Oh, my goodness. Have any of you told at other places other than, I guess, Houston?
I told in Belfast, Northern Ireland, just a couple weeks ago. I've told in Montreal quite a few times during the pandemic. This virtualness has allowed me to kind of escape these norms. I do a lot of improv as well. So I've also done improv in London and improv in Wellington, New Zealand. A lot of things, because I can, have come to my brain. And I've been like, well, why wouldn't I try this?
Well, because most of us can answer that question because scary. Susan, have you done anything bold like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess the boldest thing I did was when I had this experience where I had to have a brain tumor removed, and it wasn't cancer. And if you have to have a brain tumor removed, you want it to be like me. And in the 3 months leading up, one of the things I did was kind of looked at my bucket list and said, what do I want to do? And I was like, I've never done stand-up comedy. I think I'll just go to an open mic and do stand-up comedy about having a brain tumor.
Right. That's
and I did it, and that actually led me into storytelling, because I find that medium of the whole story instead of the punchline works better for me.
Well, I mean, that's so counterintuitive that you would have comic material out of something as scary.
You know, the thing is that the whole going through the experience of dealing with a medical issue and working through the hospital system and the medical system has an unbelievable amount of humor in it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, oh, it really shouldn't go that way, humor. But sometimes it's just, wow, this is just like, it's so weird and unexpected that it's kind of funny.
Well, I know that all three of you, what I like about your stories is that they are all about loss and grief and painful experiences. You manage to see that, I guess you laugh to keep from crying sometimes. That laughter is the best medicine kind of thing, I guess. Lottie and Paul, with your stories, I think we've got about 30 seconds. What part does humor play in your, quote, serious stories?
Sometimes I do it to get me out of that memory, just to help me get back to reality so I don't get overwhelmed with that memory again.
I always find that the more I complain about something, at some point it becomes ridiculous and I start laughing.
Thank you, Lottie. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
For coming on the show tonight. You'll come back.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
Loved it.
Well, that's it for tonight. But don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Forested land around our bayous act as the kidneys of the water system. They clean out pollutants and help manage flooding in times of high rainfall. Preventing more Houston land from being covered in concrete ensures that more of the precious little water that falls has the ability to soak into the ground and our aquifers. Living with water shortages or damaging floods brings to light how connected we all are to the natural world around us. Our health suffers without clean water and fresh air. Families suffer without safe places to spend time together outdoors. Bayou Land Conservancy, a local nonprofit organization celebrating its 20th anniversary, works to permanently protect land in the greater Houston area, with a special focus on the 13 watersheds that feed Lake Houston. Please visit our website at www.bayoulandconservancy.org or find us on social media. KPFT Houston.
Many companies will match gifts made to nonprofit organizations. A matching gift from your company will help KPFT preserve independent music, arts, news, and views for generations to enjoy. Just make a gift to KPFT this hour at kpft.org. Then contact your human resources office for eligibility requirements and to obtain a matching gift form. Many companies match the gifts of retirees, spouses,